Hey, deep fried fans. Did you know the perfect temperature to fry up catfish is 350 degrees? That's right. And the next time you cook some up, give it a try, and I promise you won't be disappointed. This is Ellie Mae here, and I'm going to announce show number 4, recorded live on June 15, 2008. Today's show is sponsored by Redgate Software. Have you ever needed to understand how your .NET code is behaving, or why it isn't behaving the way you want it to? Well, knowing how your code performs is really easy with a code profiler like Ants Profiler from Redgate. It can help you locate performance bottlenecks really quickly. It provides you with quantitative data such as hit count and code timings. It is ideal if you want to improve parts of your applications and make your algorithms run more efficiently. You can download a 14-day free trial of Ants Profiler from http://red-gate.com. Today, Keith and Woody sit down with Joe Stump, the lead architect for Dig.com. Joe has been developing large-scale LAMP websites since before Web 1.0 was Web 1.0. Joe spends his time partitioning data, creating internal services, and ensuring the code frameworks are in working order. In his spare time, he plays disc golf and works on side projects. Okay, deep fried fans, sit back, grab a glass of sweet tea, and get ready for some Gumpology.
Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
You've been at Dig for about 1.5 years now, right?
Yeah, thereabouts. I started February of 07.
Right in the heart of winter.
Well, winter where other people are from, but it was sunny and 70, I think, on my first day here. They're right in San Francisco, so great weather.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, don't make us jealous, man. I'm back here in Michigan.
Oh, I know. That's where I'm from. It's brutal. I actually have a standing rule with my family that I don't visit Michigan between the months of October and April.
Was that give you like 5 months out of the year then?
Yeah, and I actually haven't been back in about 3 years. I'm going back for my dad's 60th in July, and yeah, it kind of rules out Thanksgiving and Christmas, much to my mom's chagrin.
Well, at least if it was my mom, she'd want to come out to San Francisco to get out of the crappy weather.
Yeah, they came out here for a visit recently. They loved the weather and they hated this, like, the big city. They're just, you know, they're not big city people. So they my dad, you know, grew up on a farm and stuff. So he gets here and he just, you know, it stinks and there's all sorts of noise and, you know, which I understand.
He's like, boy, I can't park my tractor nowhere out here.
he's nowhere near that, but you know, he does, you know, he likes going. They got a nice place with like a lot of area and a dog, and there's deers that come and feed 20 feet off their back porch and stuff. You know, it's nice. You know, I'm looking forward to a couple days, you know, back on the lakes and whatnot when I get back there. It'll be good.
I lived in Michigan for 8 years, and the summers up there are absolutely awesome. I would trade the summers for Mississippi summers, but I would definitely trade the winters. And so basically, if I could have two houses, one in Michigan for the summer and then one in Mississippi for the fall and winter, I think that'd be perfect.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. I mean, Michigan is a gorgeous state, especially when you get over on the West Coast. The UP is really pretty, you know. So there's great places to go. There's great things to see. And what I tell people, like, you know, avoid the Detroit area at all costs and have a great time, you know, on the West Coast someplace, on Lake Michigan. And it's a great place to visit. I personally can't live there.
Yeah, I understand. I'm over here in Grand Rapids, and it is very different on the west side than the east side. So I don't think I could ever live back around Detroit. But I love Detroit. I love going back, seeing friends, but I don't think I could live around there.
Hey, Detroit's coming back, guys. Detroit 2.0 is on the horizon. It's coming back. Well, Joe, we're not here to talk about Michigan today. Let's talk about Dig.
Sounds good.
For those listeners that don't know about Dig, just give us an overall picture of what Dig is and why people use it.
Sure. So Dig was started by Kevin Rose, who who is from Tech TV fame, as an experiment. He, you know, Slashdot was real popular at this time. Delicious was kind of up and coming at this time. There was, you know, Fark and a few other websites that were basically, you know, Web 2.0 was just kind of starting to get off the ground there. And the whole idea of user-driven content and, you know, turning over content creation to the masses was very much in its infancy. And Kevin thought, you know, one of the big things that Slashdot was kind of always a, you know, a ding against Slashdot was like, oh, there's always this editorial there, and I really think my story's good, and but they only post 12 stories a day, and that's all you're getting, you know, kind of thing. And so Kevin had this idea where users would submit stories, and then other users would vote those stories up or down. And an internal algorithm of sorts would then promote those stories to the front page. So he started with this harebrained idea about, oh, I don't know, 2003 sometime, I think. He was still down in L.A. and found Owen, who was one of the co-founders of Dig, on like Rent-A-Coder or something like that. And paid him like a couple $1,000 to build the first version of Dig. The first version of Dig's hilarious. Like the Dig button is literally like a regular submit button. And you know, it kind of grew from there, a very small tech following. And then, you know, we've grown over the years and obviously took funding and all that stuff and gained a lot of traction. And then with Dig 3.0, I think it was version 3.0, that we expanded from technology to, you know, all sorts of different categories, sports and environment and everything like that. And I think what Dig is, you know, you hear a lot of people and they say Dig is democratizing media. And I'm not sure, I mean, we do some of that where we lower the barrier to entry and we make, you know, the editorial decisions are totally within, you know, the hands of the users. But what Dig is really good at is Dig is really good at surfacing great content. It's a way to share and surface some of the best content on the internet at a given time. So some of that great content is news. Some of that great content is video. Some of it's pictures. We have podcasts, you know. So with the explosion of user-generated media, I feel that Dig is really at the forefront of finding, cultivating, and exposing the best of that content.
So Joe, when did Dig take off? Was there a single moment or maybe a single event that made it explode?
Yes, there actually was, and it's actually really hilarious. So everybody remembers when Paris Hilton's phone was hacked? And her sidekick was hacked, and all of her pictures and all of her texts and everything was exposed. So someone submitted that story to Dig, and it became a popular story pretty quick because, you know, it's basically everything, you know, nerds love, right? It's a hot chick and getting hacked and, you know, I mean, it has all the elements of a great story. And we happened to be number one for Paris Hilton as a result of that story, and we got up there really quickly, like really quickly, while the story is basically still breaking, and it absolutely melted our servers, and that was really what put Dig on the map. So the inside joke at Dig is we need to send Paris Hilton a thank you gift.
Most people that use Dig, are they open source people, developers, Mac, Linux guys, Windows guys, technology guys? I mean, who uses Dig mostly?
So I think our main demographic, I think it's fair to say our main demographic is 18 to 34 year old males. But that being said, we long ago quit being, you know, a lot of people think, well, it's Dig, so it's a tech site. But that's not the case anymore. We actually, a number of categories do a lot more submissions, more digs, more views, more everything than technology. World and business is really popular. One of our most popular, like, categories overall, like we have subcategories underneath each one, is actually environment. Environment gets, I think, I don't know, the last time I knew, it was 2.5% of our traffic. I mean, it's a big category. Dig really has moved away from being tech-centric, but I think it's still fair to say that, by and large, our core rabid kind of user base are geeks, and they come in all flavors, all shapes, and all sizes. I think, and this could just be my perception, I think they skew a little bit more towards hardcore gamers and Apple and open source kind of guys. That's generally just that's generally my feeling.
I could see that because there's a lot of Linux articles that get digged on there, or dug, I should say. I just pulled up the homepage here, and there's one about Firefox, one about Ubuntu, one about Linux, Google, and open source projects on the homepage. So, yeah, I would say a lot of the people probably are in that realm.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, Joe, I've got a question for you. So two questions, where traffic comes from a technology standpoint and maybe from a world demographic standpoint. So can you say where most of your traffic comes from the technical side, like direct access or RSS feeds or search engines? And then maybe follow that up with how you guys break down with world traffic. I know probably most of your traffic comes from the U.S., but have you found any interesting things about where international traffic comes from?
Sure. So I would say, I mean, we do obviously a lot of direct traffic. We do real well with search engine traffic. But by and large, I would be willing to bet that, you know, a good majority of our traffic comes from those dig buttons that are sprinkled throughout the internet. You know, we have basically all the major news websites all have dig buttons. All the major video sites have dig buttons, you know, and just about
bloggers.
Just about every blog on the planet has dig buttons as well. So the dig buttons were huge for us. And they continue to be a very important part of dig strategy overall. So if I had to break it down, you know, I would say the majority of our traffic right now probably comes from search engine and dig buttons. As far as demographic, like where those are coming from, U.S. and Canada are huge, obviously. But interestingly enough, our largest metropolitan user base is London. We have more people in that metropolitan area that are using Dig than New York City, San Francisco, Seattle, anywhere like that. So I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Now that I would have never guessed.
Yeah, do you think that's because maybe London has a lot more, I mean, can you make a guess? London may have more younger technical people per like condensed.
You know, I don't know. I've been to London once, and it's a very techie city. You know, they got a lot of Facebook users. They've got, you know, a lot of stuff's going on over there as far as like I think Last.fm was founded over there and a couple other things. So, you know, I can't really put my finger on it. You know, it's like, why is Orkut so big in Brazil? I have no idea. But it is. I mean, it's by far the biggest social network in Brazil. So, you know, I think there's just naturally, you know, when you put out a tech product, it speaks to some cultures better maybe than others. I couldn't tell you why the heck that happens. But, yeah, that's the way it is. So it's kind of weird.
Okay, Joe, but how do you guys make money, though? People actually click the dig button. That doesn't make you any money by them clicking the button. But how do you guys make money? I mean, what's your business?
Sure. It's typical ad revenue. We have a partnership with Microsoft that's, you know, similar to what Facebook has. So we do advertising, just normal advertising. And then we also do... We do a lot of sponsorships. Dig Labs is and has been sponsored by Intel for quite some time, and stuff like that. So that's, you know, kind of really not my area. Every once in a while I hear, yay, we're, you know, partnered with these people or they're sponsoring this, that kind of thing. So, and we do some things that are, you know, we do some deep integration with some people that, you know, is kind of paid. That's pretty rare, though. It's basically mostly advertising and sponsorships and that kind of stuff.
So you alluded to some of the people who started Dig, but can you go in some details how it got set up and maybe some of the relationships and maybe some of the first few people that came into the company? I know you were company employee number 18, but can you give some backstory on maybe the previous 17 a little bit?
Sure. So it was founded by Kevin Rose. Owen Byrne is a co-founder. He was the guy that originally coded it for Kevin. And while this was all going on, Kevin has been good friends with Jay Adelson, who was a co-founder and CTO of Equinix, which is one of the largest data center and colocation facilities in the world, I think. And he was just chatting with him. He's like, "Yeah, I got this crazy side project." And Jay and Kevin had actually they actually started. I don't know if you guys know of Revision 3, but they had started Revision 3 after Tech TV had bombed out. And it was funny because I don't know, Kevin and Dan Heward, who is another early employee at Digg, started this podcast, this video podcast, called The Broken, and it was basically like real life hacks, like how to get free stuff from Best Buy and stuff like that. And Jay loved it so much that he basically Revision 3 became a company just so he could get more episodes of The Broken produced. And
That's
yeah, so they started Revision 3, and they're literally just getting this off the ground. It's co-founders were Dan Daniel Prager or David Prager. Dan Heward, Ron Gorodetsky, Jay Adelson, and Kevin Rose. And so Kevin gets this stick up his butt about Digg, and is like, "I'm going to do this little side project." And next thing you know, Paris Hilton has her phone hacked, and they're doing, you know, a couple million page views a month or whatever. And so he was consulting with Jay, and he's like, "Come on, you got to be CEO of this." And Jay's like, "I'm already CEO of Revision 3." And so there was a point when Jay was actually CEO of Revision 3 and Digg at the same time. And of course, he handed the reins over to Jim Lauterbach, and he's now CEO. But so that's really kind of how things started. Jay was like, "Come on, Kevin, you're killing me here." Because Kevin really, I mean, fundamentally, Kevin's an idea man. Like, I've never met anybody that is more in touch with our industry and what people want and where things are going. I mean, he's an absolute visionary as far as that goes. Like, the guy is, I don't know how he does it. I mean, he is constantly 10 steps ahead of where things are going. So that's after that, Kevin brought on, he brought Dan on. Dan does site administration. He brought Ron Gorodetsky on, who is one of the best systems guys I've ever worked with. And then, had a few other hires before me, Eli White, who's really big in the PHP community, Steve Williams, who's big in the data portability community. We have a resident JavaScript nerd, Micah Snyder. Who else do we bring on? Mike Mazur is our chief revenue officer. Brought him on from EA. And really from there, you know, once we had our VPs kind of in place, it was about building out teams, you know, getting more engineers in, more operations people. We have a couple of people that are actually from Apple. Scott Baker is our VP of operations, absolutely top notch. And then we have Mike Newton, who's from Apple as well. So really, once they, you know, Jay was really good about bringing in, you know, a couple good people at what they did as far as, you know, this or that, and then the good VPs, and then it was a matter of letting them build out their teams from there. So that's really, you know, the people behind it. And since then, you know, obviously I don't even know where we're at now. There are people there that do stuff, and I don't even know who they are or what they do. We're like in the mid-60s or something like that now.
As you grow, then you start losing focus with everybody that's around you. You just sort of get in your own little cubbyhole and do your own thing and go to work.
Well, it's all about the teams that you work with. That's the thing. I mean, bigger companies, you start breaking down into smaller teams that are more manageable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've been going through that in engineering. We grew to 13 pretty quickly. I think we're at 15 now. We're hiring, by the way, digg.com/jobs. Basically, you know, we're getting to the point where you obviously can't have 13 people on one team. So we broke that down, and we have a tools and integration partnership team that basically they deal with Facebook app, all the Digg buttons, you know, anything that is Digg being projected externally. And then we have a site applications team. They handle all the front end code for, you know, story lists and permalink and submission and that kind of stuff. And then we have my baby, the core infrastructure team, that deals with, you know, all of the core frameworks and the core infrastructure stuff.
And that's where we're going to go next, I think. Before we get to the actual core infrastructure and all of your fun stuff that you're doing, give us some interesting stats about Digg. I mean, we know Digg's a very large site, gets a lot of traffic, so give us some interesting numbers.
Sure. So I think we're somewhere around the 80th to the 100th largest site in the world, somewhere around there. I don't know the exact number. We're, I think, the 30th or something largest website, somewhere around there, largest website in the U.S. We do 26 million uniques a month. And that's really only half the story. So the 26 million unique number is like, that's what we tell advertisers, right? Like, this is how many eyeballs you get. But that's really only half the story at Digg. So the other half of the story is we have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of applications that are built on top of our API. We have smart Digg buttons that are sprinkled over probably thousands of websites at this point. So in reality, we actually, like, the actual requests that hit our stack a month is in the billions. I don't even know the number. Probably somewhere between, somewhere in the upper, close to 2 billion probably. And then we do, during peak hours, we do right around 10,000 requests a second to our stack. During Macworld, for instance, you know, because Gizmodo and you know, Crunchgear and all those guys are live blogging that, and they all, of course, have smart Digg buttons on their on those posts, and those are refreshing every, you know, whatever, 10 seconds or whatever. And then, of course, we have people that are constantly refreshing on Digg's front page waiting for the iPhone story or whatever to hit. So this last Worldwide Developer Conference that just happened, you know, whatever, a week ago, I think we peaked at just over 27,000 requests a second. So yeah, a lot of traffic. Only half the story is really our uniques that you know, gets quoted and whatnot. So,
and just to clarify, whenever you say, you know, goes into your core, you're talking about you know, somebody pressed a Digg button somewhere on some other website that has to get registered in a Digg. They didn't go to your website, but there was a post that was made into your web server that had to log that transaction. So it had to go all the way through your back end, basically.
Right. So when I say like hit our stack, it basically made its way through the gauntlet of our caching. Cause I mean, you know, we do front end caching and stuff like that. And actually hit an Apache web server that gets processed, you know, by PHP and may or may not hit Memcache and MySQL and all that stuff as well. So
cool. Very good numbers.
Very good.
That's impressive.
What are you guys projecting for the rest of the year, maybe next year? Are you guys looking at doubling your traffic or tripling or kind of doubling every 18 months, or what's your number?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I don't know. I really try to keep my nose out of the business side, just because Digg is really nice from the standpoint of, it's the only place that I've ever worked where their hiring process is extremely stringent. And like I said, it took me like 5 months from initial contact to starting or something like that. And the people that Jay and Kevin have surrounded themselves with are, in my opinion, top notch. I mean, there's bar none, nobody better at what they do, it seems like, whenever we hire someone in. And except me, I somehow managed to slip through the cracks. But
oh, you beat me to that one.
And so I don't have to worry about the guy next to me in the cube doing his job. So I don't honestly know, you know, like what our projections are or where they want us to be. And I honestly don't worry myself with that, because I have complete faith that Mike and Jay and Kevin and John and those guys on that side of the fence are going to do what needs to be done to get, you know, to take us where they think we need to go. As far as where we've been and where we're at now, I think when I started a year and a half ago, we were at like about half of where we're at now, like 12 million uniques. So we've doubled in size since I've come on board as far as traffic goes. So, and I don't know, I don't even have access to our web log, so I couldn't even tell you, you know, how things are trending, to be honest.
Cool. So let's talk about Digg, the technology. What are the various cogs that are out there in your system and how they all fit together? And I mean, you've alluded to some of them, like Apache and MySQL and PHP, but kind of tell us as much as you can about how it's kind of architected and built together.
Sure. So Digg is, you know, there's a lot of people, I think, have this perception that, you know, especially our moms, right? They just think that there's like this one computer sitting someplace that looks just like their computer that, you know, serves all these requests, which of course couldn't be further from the truth. So at the front end, we have a couple load balancers, just typical load balancing appliances, and then, you know, a bunch of pretty standard. We run just Linux, Debian Linux. We're actually all Debian, and then Apache and PHP on our application servers. And then behind that is where really all the different cogs come together. We're pretty vanilla Apache forward. And then behind that, we store all of our files on a distributed file system that's actually built on top of WebDAV called Mogile FS, which is actually, I don't know what the word is, but when you mix the letters together and it comes up with a different one, it stands for Oh My God Files, and it's Mogile FS. And basically, what you do is there's a couple tracker servers that you randomly select that keep track of all the data nodes, which are just Apache web servers with WebDAV on them. And you ask the tracker, you know, I have this type of file, where do I store it? And the tracker server responds back with one or more data nodes, and you just do a regular put and, you know, or post, and it puts that file on a couple different web servers. So that's how we store all the user icons, all the user images, all of the story icons, etc. We rely heavily on Memcache. I don't know of a single major website at this point that isn't relying on Memcache, and that includes people that are Java shops and Windows and, you know, everything. Memcache is very core to what we do. And Memcache is this little daemon that you install on servers that exposes RAM over TCP/IP and UDP now. And it's just a big hash lookup table. And you can have a bunch of different servers use consistent hashing and whatnot to figure out, you know, like, I need to store this user record on, and it hashes it to a server. And then for storage, for database, we use MySQL. We have a couple different masters. We store, you know, so we've hit a point where obviously not all of our writes can go to a single database server. So we need to have, for instance, the interleaved view of your user activity is in a table called user actions. And we put that on a database cluster over here, and then we put items and users on this one, and then comments over here, and that kind of thing. And then we use MySQL replication to scale out the reads from there. Probably my favorite piece, this is actually Memcache. You ask people that, you know, that before they use Memcache, they're like, this is kind of weird. It's hard to explain. Why the heck would I ever need this? You know, it's a novel concept. I'm going to expose memory over TCP/IP, and then that's how I'm going to cache things. But it works exceptionally well. And this new product that that we're using is a queuing system, except for, again, it's not quite what I would call a queuing system, but it's called GearMan, and that's a anagram. That's what's called for manager. And basically, it's a traditional queue in the sense that I can stuff a background job in there, and then there's these worker bees. That are just processes distributed across however many boxes as you want, that will then be, the GearMan server will say, oh, well, you're available, so you do this task, and it does it. But it's interesting in this fact that you can also say, you can create what they call a task set. And the task set could, for instance, let's say it's a permalink on Digg, you could say, I need to grab the current user who's logged in, I need to grab their information, I need to grab the permalink story information, and then I needed to grab all the comments. So what you could do is you could create a task set with those three things in it, send it to GearMan. GearMan would find three workers and run all three of those in parallel, and those workers can then return results, which then get reduced and sent back to the client all at once. So it's really interesting. It's one of those things that once you wrap your brain around it, you're like, holy crap, how did I ever live without it? So we use that at Digg. I created a distributed logging system that we use that for. And then I also, the the crawling process during submission also uses Gearman now, and we're going to be using that more and more and more. It's really a great way. It's great for what I call near time processing. It's, you know, you need this done quickly, but so more quickly than you would if you were to do something via cron. But you basically need to push this chunk of processing off to something else and let it handle it in the background. And it's exceptional at doing that. So those are really the main components of what makes Digg work. Mogile for files, Memcache for caching, MySQL for database, Gearman for queues, Apache, PHP on the front end, and then load balancers to make it all spread across evenly.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I'm really amazed by the small team that you have, really. I mean, 15 people doesn't sound like a lot to manage all that, so I'm impressed.
Yeah, well, I mean, Digg is a little bit, I mean, it's, so 15 is just the coders. We actually have an operations team that handles all the actual, like, keeping things up and running as far as servers and the services go, and then we build everything on top of that. So I think we've got three sysadmins, two DBAs, a network guy, and then Scott is the VP and, you know, kind of manages all of that over there. So
but you're still under 25, right?
Yeah, we're about 25.
I mean, for a company Digg size and your traffic and your exposure, I would have thought that you would have had maybe twice that number. So I mean, you must have really smart people there.
Yeah, I work with I'm really, really fortunate that I go in to work every day and I work with some of the best coders in the world, and I work with, in my opinion, I know of one other systems guy as far as just straight, you know, sysadmin stuff that's better than my operations team, or as good anyway, and you know, he manages genome clusters over at the Joint Genome Institute. So, yeah, we have just a top-notch team. I can't complain in any way. Ron is, I can't say enough good things about that guy. He's just, he's top-notch. Keeps everything humming, and we have a really good rapport. It's kind of funny. We have this joke called the blame script. Operations has blame.sh, and it defaults to my name, unfortunately. But, yeah.
That's a shell script.
Yeah. So it's funny. We'll be in IRC and like something will be hiccuping on the site or whatever, and Ron will just type /blame.sh, and it's good. It's a great environment, and I'm pretty impressed with what we do. You know, I like to think that it shows, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, Joe, it definitely sounds like you really enjoyed it there. Let's pretend for a second. Let's pretend that the traffic at Digg doubled within the next week. What do you think would be your biggest bottlenecks?
Sure. So one of the things I love hearing people drone on about is we all know them. They're what I call the language zealot, right? They're the person that's, you know, Java sucks, or PHP is ugly, or Ruby doesn't scale, or, you know, on and on and on. And I'm going to say it, and I know nobody's going to listen to me because it's a religion, and that's their core belief, but languages don't matter. They don't matter when it comes to your architecture, because 100% of the time when you have a problem scaling, it's I/O. It doesn't have anything to do with, oh, crap, I used a for each loop instead of a for I loop or whatever. And if you're optimizing your language, and then you're not looking in the right place, because CPU cycles on PHP, or, you know, just generic CPU cycles, we've already figured that problem out. You put a couple load balancers out there and you start adding boxes. That's not the issue. And it doesn't matter what language you're using. Load balancers, bunch of web servers, done.
But would you say that some languages would cost you more money to buy more servers?
I'm not going to argue that, right? I mean, with .NET, you have licensing costs. With Ruby, Ruby fundamentally is a slower language than other languages, but it won't be for long. you know, there's a huge community behind Ruby. They're going to make that language faster. So would Ruby cost you 5 more servers? Would, you know, would .NET cost you 1 more server? Would PHP, you know, cost you more servers than Java? Sure. But at the end of the day, my philosophy on languages are find something that your developers will be happy with, that will make them efficient, and, you know, obviously you don't want to program a site like Dig in, say, Bash or Set or Awk or something like that. That totally doesn't make any sense.
Lisp for the win.
Actually, you know what's funny? Reddit was written in Lisp. The first version of Reddit was written in Lisp. I think it's in Django and in Python now. But fundamentally, I mean, when you're going to do web, if you're doing Python, Perl, PHP, .NET, Ruby, or Java, you're fine. Like, you know, like at the end of the day, if you can find 15 .NET developers that can crank out code and that costs you 2 extra servers and those 2 extra servers cost you $5,000, it's a no-brainer. You go with .NET and you let them rock out and do what they do. The real problems that we run into, for instance, I think we were just down the other day, and for some reason the slaves just went crazy. The disk I/O on the slaves went bonkers, and things started falling over from there. So the problems that we deal with daily, we deal with indexes. We're hitting the wrong index. Sometimes MySQL's finicky about which index it uses. Sometimes we have to force the right one. Sometimes we need to optimize that. If you aren't already, I'm a normalization SQL snob, but you have to denormalize. You have to avoid joins. You have to avoid large scans. You need to break up your data across multiple databases. So, you know,
give us an example of that, Joe.
Sure. So one of the things that we're getting ready to do is we're getting ready to partition the user's table and the user's data. And what that means is, for instance, users 1 through 1,000 is on this server, users 1,001 through 2,000 is on this server, et cetera, et cetera. A little bit, we have things a little bit set up a bit more complex than that, but that's the general idea of partitioning your data across multiple servers. And of course, that allows us to add more and more users, and that allows us to scale out our writes. One of the biggest problems that people hit, I'd say the two most common problems people hit is one, database I/O, which is normally solved with adding lots of read slaves on MySQL, for instance, or adding memcache. And the other one that they hit that normally isn't necessarily a bottleneck, but is definitely an I/O problem and causes a problem with Apache and stuff. Like, you know, when you have like 5 web servers, you're like, oh, no problem, I'll just use NFS. Don't stop like right there. It's like that's the worst thing you can do.
Do not pass go.
Yeah, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. take your NFS and light it on fire. Mogile is a great answer to that. There's a couple other, you know, obviously enterprise-y solutions for that out there as well. So really, it all comes down to when you have problems scaling, it's always I/O. Unless you have, you know, like some 14-year-old cousin of yours coding your site, then it might be PHP. But I'd be real surprised if that was it.
So your big thing is just it's reading stuff off and writing stuff off a disk, basically.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you need to be able to make sure that, you know, it's the classic, you know, problem of throughput. It's versus performance, right? It's like I need to be able to store, I don't know, we have like 200 some odd million digs, and when you get tables that big, you start running out of hard drive space. You start running out of, you know, you can't do date scans on it anymore because the index is, you know, 2 gigs or whatever. Or the real problem that you have is your database is bigger than the amount of RAM you can stuff on a box, which means that MySQL has to go to disk every time it wants to do a join, which is horrible.
Sure.
So really, when you get to the size where you're storing as much data as we are, it's a difference of throughput. Like, I need to be able to do a whole bunch of this. Like, I don't care if it takes me a little bit longer. I just need to be able to make sure that I can handle all of this in a reasonable amount of time. So, if I hear people that are like, you know, Keith, you've done PHP, so you know, like, the classic thing where people go through and optimize their code by switching from double quotes to single quotes. It's like, stop. Like, that's not that's not the fundamental issue in your architecture. Like, you know, if your database is screaming at, you know, a load of 10, going and adding single quotes is not going to help your case at all.
Do you guys find yourself doing any type of premature optimization as you code because of your size and your scale? Or do you just, I mean, are you really just say, look, guys, just throw it out there, get it done?
Yeah. We're,
where do you draw the line?
Yeah, we're at the size now where we can't do that at all. One of the things that, actually this came up recently, there was there was this like unoptimized portion sitting somewhere in a dustbin on our site, basically. And these things exist on every site where you're like, nobody's ever going to use this thing, the about page, right? Like, let's say it's the about page. You're like, well, I want to show the employees on the about page like we do at Dig. But nobody's ever going to go there. So I'm going to do this query live, and I'm going to do it against a master. Because nobody cares, right? Next thing you know, you get some spider that goes out of control and just hammers on that about page for some reason, and your site goes down, right? So, I mean, we're at the point now where when we start architecting something, we immediately assume that there's going to be, you know, a million people a day banging on it.
It's going to be your next Paris Hilton.
Yeah, yeah. So no matter what, I'm always, whenever I think, it's a kind of this inside joke that as long as everything is massively sharded, that's my term, massively sharded. So massively, like sharding means that, you know, what we talked about before, it's also called federation or partitioning, where you spread stuff across multiple servers and then hash based on some sort of hashing algorithm to different servers. And so the inside joke for me is like, you know, it's got to be massively sharded. And, you know, and then it's like, you know, who cares if it doesn't take off? Like, we're still prepared and, you know, whatnot. So, yeah.
Well, you don't want to get caught, you know, with your pants down, obviously, so.
Right, right, yeah. And that's the thing, too, is, you know, there's a lot of exposure with Dig. So we have a lot of people that poke and prod different places on the site. So we basically, you know, we really need to be prepared no matter what.
Hey, Joe, so you talked about kind of when we were pre-show talking about some coding practices and bringing up some patterns that you use. But, I mean, do you sit down with the coding teams, with the dev teams, and say, this is what we're going to do. These are the patterns that we're going to use. I mean, how do you do that? Do you do that from top down? Do you kind of let it go organic and bubble up? Or, I mean, explain how you build your teams and how you build your development philosophies.
Sure. So, my personal philosophy on coding in general is that, you know, you hear people joke, it was hard to write, it should be hard to read. And I have been fighting ever since I heard that.
I love it, man. That is great. I'm going to use that maybe for my tagline.
That was in my signature for a long time.
So I've had to maintain so much horrible code that I swore to myself that I would never in my life perpetuate this whole idea of it was hard to write, it should be hard to read. So one of the first things that I kind of pushed when I got on board at Dig was that, you know, we should have clearly stated and clearly adhered to coding standards. So we adopted. I'm really lazy, so I just went ahead and adopted the pair coding standards. We have a few modifications. We basically sat down in a big powwow. There was about seven of us on board at that time and said, I'm fine with all of this except for this. You know, so we carved out a few things, but by and large, we use pair coding standards. In my opinion on coding standards, you know, that this is another area in coding where people tend to get religious, you know, like canR, no, one true brace, you know, and all this other stuff. I don't care. Just pick one that everybody agrees on and run with it. And part of the pair coding standards, of course, is everything needs to have PHP doc blocks, which is similar to Java doc. So we try to do a really good job of doing inline documentation. Any code that we release publicly must strictly adhere to the pair coding standards. So we've released a number of packages, NetGearMan, FileMogile, ServicesDig, etc., that are all, you know, fully documented.
Now, Joe, for those that don't know what pair is, explain what pair is.
Yeah, so pair is to PHP as what CPN is to Perl. Pair stands for the PHP Extension and Application Repository, and it's this centralized database of, like, you know, logging libraries, database abstraction layers, all sorts of web services, packages, you know, all on down the line. And it works much like app from Debian or RPM from Red Hat or, you know, whatever, where you just basically say pair install some package and it installs it, you know, globally and for your PHP and stuff like that. So we're really active in that community. I think we have 6 or 7 active pair developers on Dig. And we, between us, we maintain about 20 some odd packages in pair. As far as other philosophies, you know, code repository obviously is a must. We use SVN. Bug tracker, of course, is a must. I'm a big believer in track plus SVN. I'm in heaven with that thing because it's so well integrated and everything's wikified. So, like, I can literally make wiki links in my SVN commit messages and those get attached to tickets and, you know, link from there and stuff. So my general philosophies are, you know, pick a language that you enjoy developing in, pick a coding standard that everybody can agree on without breathing fire. At the bare minimum, you should be using inline documentation that does API, you know, documentation automatically, and then code repository with a bug tracker. So that's my general philosophy.
So how do you guys do your builds? Do you have a continuous integration or nightly builds, or what? How do you do that?
So that's kind of all in flux right now. I know that they're working on. We have a QA team as well. And I know that they're working on it, and that's something that I found that when I moved into the lead position, it was either attempt to, you know, have your finger in every pie, or only stick your fingers into the pies that you felt were really kind of, you know, really your bread and butter. Like, the QA guys, we have some amazing QA guys. They're much smarter at that crap than I am. So they're working on the continuous integration environment. We use Selenium for browser-based testing, and we use both PHP unit and PHPT for code unit tests. I have no idea what our coverage is on that kind of stuff. Yeah, I mean, we have a release manager. We're also moving to using Pear, actually, to distribute our code, to push our code. So, and it's kind of interesting. Actually, the operations team and our build and release manager, Steve Williams, managed that whole process. So Ron's got some magic push script that, you know, it does a couple of things. It minifies our JavaScript and compresses, you know, CSS and uses YUI compressor to do all that stuff. And, does some rolling up of some various files and, you know, pushes it all out and stuff like that. So we don't do, I mean, it's a little bit different, obviously, with web where, you know, we don't do necessarily nightly builds. But I know we're working that way. That's kind of in QA land at this point.
So I have a question for you. I mean, we're talking very detailed technical aspects of Dig, but I hear over and over again how you praise teammates and you praise people in Dig. Don't you think that having a great coding practice and some good philosophies on development goes equal with having that trust that you give to teammates and other people in your company? Just like you said, you have this, it sounds like you have this like ironclad trust that the QA guys are going to come up with the best solution to make not only their lives good, but your life and your developer lives equally as enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, you're only as good as your people. And, you know, I keep saying we've been very fortunate with the people that we have at Dig. Jeremy, our QA manager, is, I mean, he's just so methodical and so thoughtful and, you know, has such foresight. So, yeah, I mean, you have to be able to trust the guy sitting in the cube next to you that he's doing his job. And without that intrinsic trust, you know, you're kind of dead in the water at that point. And really, the only way to kind of cultivate that trust is to, you know, to be heads down, do your job. And I'm really also big on empowering people to make the decisions elsewhere. You know, like being the lead architect, I get consulted or attempted to be brought in on a lot of things. And I think it's just as important for me to say, nope, I trust that you have this handled, as it is for me to come in and actually give my input. So, you know, the QA people, you know, Jeremy and a couple of those guys and came over and they're like, well, we want you to come in and sit down in this meeting. I'm like, dude, I know you got it handled. I don't, you know, I trust that you're going to take care of it. And I think that, you know, when you have teammates, and this happens with me too, you know, where I'll go to Ron and I'll be like, hey, I got this harebrained scheme. And he's like, I know you got it covered, dude. Don't worry about it. So I think when you tell people that and when people tell that to you, you know, you feel an obligation at that point, right? It's like, well, or when Ron says to me, you know, trust me, I trust you, you got it handled. I got to make sure that I've got it handled. Otherwise Ron's going to yell at me. So, Ron's not going to yell at me, but, so yeah, I think, you know, you're right that the trust is a big thing. We've been really fortunate that it's not an issue. The people that we have in place, they get their work done and they do what they need to do. And I don't even have to circle back. That's what's so great. I mean, you know, a lot of the people, when we do circle back, it's like, I didn't even need to do this. Like, you know, you guys clearly got a handle. So it's nice.
It sounds like everybody's empowered.
Definitely. Definitely, definitely, definitely. You know, we have, for instance, we brought on a kid, Jeff Hodson, that's, I think he just turned 19. He looks about 12. And we call him the dig intern.
Dig turn, that's funny.
Yeah, and, you know, the first thing we did is we handed him the iPhone app and said, hey, you know, this needs to be expanded, it needs to be cleaned up, it needs to be ported to our new MVC layer. And, you know, that one little snippet of our website gets, you know, 1.5 million page views or something like that a month, which is like more traffic than any other website he's ever worked on. And he's done great with it. You know, I mean, a few typical normal, you know, 19-year-old coder mistakes, but by and large, he's, you know, doing great code. So
is it going to be done for July 11th?
You know, I don't know when that's slated to go out. It's code complete. But we're in the middle of doing some major infrastructure re-architecting right now, and I'm not sure when that's going to go out. I think it's going to go out sometime in July. I don't know. I don't think it'll make July 11th though.
Now, being an architect, Joe, there's probably an acronym that you're familiar with. It's called SOA. Describe it, Dig. What are you doing with services, service-oriented architecture, and what are your thoughts on what you're doing, where you're moving to, where you see things going?
Sure. So at Dig, you know, one of the things that I really push for in both code and architecture is abstraction. And one of the things that SOA gets you really quite nicely is decoupling your data storage from your data consumption. I feel that that's a big win. You know, all I know is that I have this URL. I send an HTTP request to it, and it sends me back either XML or serialized JSON or, you know, serialized PHP or whatever. And so that's a big win with SOA. Another big win that, you know, I think a lot of people tend to, and this is kind of a hard, kind of a weird thing to wrap the brain around, is that normally when you're doing requests against MySQL or Postgres or whatever, it's both synchronous and it's a blocking call. So, you know, your script's not doing jack crap when, you know, it's requesting data from the database and getting it back. Whereas with SOA, you can run requests in parallel and asynchronously. So if you create a non-blocking socket and you shove an HTTP request down it, your script can continue going on and doing whatever it needs to do, while on the other end, that open socket, there's an HTTP server that's working on serving up the data for that request. And of course, the expense of opening a non-blocking socket and shoving a GET request down it is, you know, in the hundredths of a millisecond kind of thing. So
it's, let's come back up for a second. Come back up the stack a little bit, Joe.
Sure, sure.
Whenever you're doing services, there's different types. There's what we call RESTful services. You mentioned JSON, which is JavaScript, Serialize, and PHP. There's also SOAP. There's some hybrids. What are you guys doing mostly in terms of XML? Are you guys doing REST, or you just do your own hybrid, or what?
Yeah, so we're definitely implementing REST. Each endpoint supports post, put, get, and delete. And the way that I do it, so I'm not really religious on the return type. You know, some people like XML, some people like JSON, some people like, you know, serialize, you know, like Perl has freeze and PHP has serialize, that kind of thing. So really what we do is we create our services in a very RESTful manner, and then we have each service return a very vanilla data structure. In PHP, we just have them return arrays. And then the services layer will look at basically the extension. And if it's .xml, it serves up that thing in XML. If it's .json, it serves up in JSON. If it's .php, it serves it up in serialized PHP. So it's definitely custom, it's very RESTful, and then as far as the data serialization, we support any number of those.
What about the versioning of your services? Are you finding a lot of issues with that and keeping track of where you expose services to the public one way, and then you want to change them down the road, but you can't?
Sure. So when we when I first went out and started kind of researching SOA kind of hardcore, I knew that this was the direction that we needed to go. I started talking, you know, my friends at Google, my friends at Amazon and Yahoo, and they all across the board were like, yeah, you got to version your services, because you never know when, you know, Yahoo is a perfect example, right? They have sports over here, and they have real estate over here, and they have mail over there, and, you know, on and on and on. And you never know when sports is going to, you know, break this endpoint on their SOA layer. So they would version that stuff. So it's like, you know, real estate over here needs to ping news over here, and news breaks it, you know, or creates a new endpoint for some other thing, and, you know, everybody's happy because whatever they're consuming still works. We don't version our external service yet. And I'm not really sure, you know, we only have one external service, and that'll probably always pretty much stay the same. I can't imagine us really versioning that. Maybe. I don't know.
How are you handling your versionings? Are you doing like folder structures, like, you know, v1.1/something, and then you're doing versions like that? Are you doing versioning in the actual message bodies, or?
Mm-hmm. So we actually do it in the URL. So the URL is, you know, URLs don't cost you anything. My opinion on this is that, you know, putting /1.0 at the beginning of your URI costs you nothing. So just do it. Even if you're not going to version anything, just put it in there, because God only knows when you might. So our actual URL structure internally for our internal REST stuff will be like /1.0/, you know, what I call service groupings. Or for instance, like users, items, friends, that kind of thing. And then, you know, slash some canonical ID, like a user ID, slash something else, .xml or .php or .json or whatever.
You mentioned Amazon. I've actually been on Amazon's website where I was using something, then I got an error. We have discontinued this version of this service. Try a different version. So
yeah, Amazon's really big on web services, and I have a buddy over there who works on the EC2 team, and I've relied heavily on his input, and they do some amazing things over there with web services, and all of their stuff is versioned, and he's you know, he was a big proponent, big pusher of, you know, you got to version your internal services. And the reason that they do that is so they know where those, you know, they know where those requests are coming from. They know which IPs those are coming from, and they can say, you know, they can send out emails to various groups and say, you know, you need to upgrade to 2.0 or sunsetting 1.5. And, you know, obviously what happened there is one of the groups didn't upgrade.
Whoops.
Yeah, whoops.
Hey, Joe, I'm always interested in knowing how people code, what they use to code, and maybe some apps that they find interesting that helps them be more productive. C- kind of give your philosophy on that and some things that you use daily that make your job easier.
Sure. I'm probably the worst person to ask this question of because I am such a purist that I still code in Vim. If you saw me code...
Vim is like the VI editor?
Vim? VI improved, which is, I believe at this point, in order to be a POSIX Unix, you have to ship Vim. But it's a text editor. It's similar to like Emacs. When you walk by, you know, I have a big 30-inch LCD, and I literally just have 9 terminals, 80 by 24 terminals open with Vim and Shell on them. And so I do 100% of my coding in an 80 by 24 term with Vim and Shell scripts up the wazoo. And, you know, I still use SVN on the command line. My Vim RC is only about 20 lines. But I have such muscle memory at this point that I can't even, like, I go into shell shock if I think about, like, GUI editors and whatnot. I'm sure they probably make me more efficient, but I'm too far down the rabbit hole at this point.
So you're kind of the poster boy for pragmatic programming, huh?
Yeah, I am such a big fan of being pragmatic. I have a couple friends that are what I call language fetishists. You know, they whenever the new language comes out, they immediately jump on that bandwagon. And the perfect one is I know a lot of people that were in PHP, and then the two bandwagons that people jump from PHP to were either Ruby or Python. And I love Python. I have no disrespect for Ruby. Personally, I feel that Ruby syntactically looks like the bastard stepchild of Python and Perl. So the syntax, I can't wrap my brain around because it looks like Perl, and that drives me nuts. But if you use it, that's fine, and we'll sell beers, and that's cool. And then it seems like those two people, you know, those people now have jumped to Erlang, and it's just like, Jesus, guys, can't you just pick a tool and stick with it? The other one, too, is like people jump from Subversion to Git, you know, and they're always constantly changing their tools, and I have no idea how people do that. It's like you're not being very productive if you're constantly changing languages and tools. I mean, these are fundamental tools, you know. It's just weird.
I've known you for, what, 10 years probably, Joe?
Probably thereabout, yeah.
Somewhere in there. And I can remember you and I swapping... We used to swap VMRC files. For those that don't know, the VI editor keeps all of the actual, not permissions, just the settings in a file called .vimrc. And I can remember you and I swapping VMRC files and tricks and stuff of that. And that was 10 years ago, and you haven't changed in 10 years.
I can tell you right now, Keith, if you dug up one of those emails with my VimRC file and diffed it against the VimRC file I have now, maybe 5 of the 20 lines have changed.
That's funny. What else do you use?
I'm a Mac guy. I'm a true blue Apple fanboy. I'm chugging the Kool-Aid. I can't wait for iPhone 2 to come out. I kind of bounce back and forth between Firefox and Safari. I find Safari is a bit more stable for me at this point. But Firefox has this thing called Firebug, which if you're a web developer using Firebug, you need to jump on that bandwagon immediately. Firebug, I can't tell you. Like, Firebug has that, or Firefox has Firebug. Safari has something called Web Inspector that is similar to Firebug, and it does a lot of the things that Firebug does. And then you have
But it's just not as good.
It's not as good. It's good. I would say it's like it's 70%. It's like 70% as good. But Firefox, Joe Hewitt has basically made all of my wet dreams come true. And as far as like how to debug in a browser, and Safari doesn't quite have all of my answers. And then IE makes me want to kill myself. Like, I don't understand why they don't ship solid developer tools for that thing. Like, I've looked into it, and there's like this one archaic .exe file that you can use that will tell you, that'll basically show you it'll actually show you which line caused the error, and then there's a bunch of add-ons that you have to pay for to like debug IE. I don't understand that. Maybe you guys can speak to that, but
I think it's because there's no money in it. So what's the point of spending all the R&D on building that when the third-party development community could actually build it? But I don't think nobody's really built a great one. I think we call it Firebug at this point. So
yeah, everyone just flaps over to use Firebug, and then that's their default.
I mean, what's the point of Microsoft building a development tool besides the developers wanting it? It's a better experience for development on the platform, but there's no money in it, so there's probably no pressing. That's my guess.
There is a developer toolbar, but it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they could do a lot more with it, but they choose not to. They choose to let their partner ecosystem and the community ecosystem build stuff like that.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I ran into one thing. So I mean, by and large, if I'm doing an Ajax thing or, JavaScript or CSS or anything like that, I'm definitely using Firefox and Firebug as my primary development tool. And, you get to a point and you're like, all right, it works here. You flip over to Safari. You might have to, do one or two tweaks in Safari. And then you move over to the dreaded IE6. And there's always these crazy, outlandish things that for some reason don't work. A perfect example of something that I ran into, we're trying not to send a whole bunch of HTML down the pipe. So one of the things that we did with the comment system, not the one that we just launched, but the one before that is after we shoved all the basic HTML down the pipe, we would go and add the form elements. When you clicked reply, we would actually dynamically create that form. And one of the things I did is I would say, element equals, new element or whatever, and then element.type is hidden or something like that, or button or submit. And IE won't allow you to change the input's type dynamically. Safari and Firefox don't care, but IE would crash, boom, browser window's gone. I'm like, what the heck is going on here? And it took me forever, and I finally realized that in order to do that, I had to create at the very beginning, and if you look at the old JavaScript file, there was the very top, there's var input equals, window dot document create element or whatever input, and then I would clone that. Clone those as I needed to. So there would be there was a button and a hidden input up at the very top, and I would clone those as I needed them. And that took me, I think, it took me and our resident JavaScript guru probably 3 days to figure that one out. Because there's no debugger. It would drove me nuts, So I just wish those kind of things.
How do you actually run the IE? Are you running it in a VM?
Yeah, we all have Parallels. Dig is at this point a 100% Mac shop. I think a couple of the financial people have Windows because they need native Excel and native Quicken. The rest of us are all Mac and we all have Parallels. And depending on some of us install Linux and stuff. There's a couple Linux guys out there and whatnot. But yep, Mac with Parallels. I think I have XP installed on mine. Now that I'm on the infrastructure stuff, I don't really do a lot of parallel development kind of stuff.
So Joe, so you have your people on your team, are they local? Do they come to the office every day? Are they remote, or is there a mix?
By and large, they're all local. We have Eli. Eli White lives out in Maryland. He's our one remote coder. And then we have site admins. Obviously, we want people keeping track of terms of service and user complaints and that kind of stuff 24/7. So we have a guy over in Europe that does that remotely. And I think we have a rec out right now for somebody to do that in the UK as well. Maybe in Ulster. I don't know. Somewhere. But so, yeah, I mean, 98% of Dig works locally. And then we have a few exceptions to that rule.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Being an architect at one of the largest internet trafficked sites out there, Joe, I'm sure you have some opinion on what people think about Twitter going down and other large sites going down. So do you have any comments for our listeners?
Yeah. It's really funny. I know Blaine really well from Twitter. He's a great guy, great architect. I know I know some people over at Yahoo. I know some people over at Amazon that, they've got really talented people over there. I mean, these are not they don't have bottom of the barrel engineers. I mean, these are the brightest and best people of our generation working on some of the toughest problems of our generation, And I always find it funny that there's this huge backlash, whenever Twitter goes down or whenever, Amazon went down recently, and they have, you know, I think the average person really doesn't understand what it takes and how many cogs and how many different moving pieces there are to these websites that they go to. You know, when you go to Amazon, you hit any one of 50,000 servers that are distributed globally. I mean, they can literally shut down 10,000 servers, and those all immediately fail over to 10,000 other servers within milliseconds. And I can't even, I mean, I work, you know, Digg's a big site, but I can't even fathom that kind of scale and, you know, those kind of problems. So,
sure, me neither.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, I think, you know, at Digg, we do, you know, quite a few, you know, things per second, and Amazon does $36,000 or something like that a minute, and, you know, then you have Twitter that does hundreds of these messages a second, and it's like, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, for instance, you know, you guys talked about Plurk beforehand and how this is a competitor of Twitter, and one of the things that people always say about Plurk is they're like, well, you know, Plurk stays up. It's like, give me a break, you know, Plurk has one millionth probably the traffic that Twitter does. They don't have anywhere near as many users, you know, so it's easy to keep a site up when you only have 10,000 people using it. It's difficult to keep a site up when you...
Oh, and you don't have the services wrapped around it that you're just a website.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Twitter has so many entry points. You know, you can tweet through IM, you can use the HTTP API, you can use Jabber, you can use SMS, you can use the web. I mean, there's so many points of entry. Like, and think about it. Those are five distinct services. And how do you keep them all online, and how do you keep them from running over each other? What happens when I tweet and I SMS at exactly the same time, you know, from IM and SMS? Like, so there's really difficult problems when you're dealing with scale. One of the things that I always like to say, you know, Web 2.0 brought about user-generated content, and I don't give a flying hoot about that picture of your grandma that you posted, you know, 10 years ago, but I will not stand in your way of actually accessing that data. So it's like, I have all this junk that I need to store, and I don't really care about a lot of it because it's not mine, but I still have to make it work, and I still have to scale it out. And if Web 2.0 has taught us anything, it's that people love making crap and sharing it with the world. And I don't see that stopping anytime soon. So, you know,
well, that's all YouTube is.
Yeah,
right?
that's what YouTube is. I'm really good friends with Cal from Flickr, and, you know, his war stories are hilarious. You know, you get these people that, like, you know, they're uploading 5,000 images a minute or whatever, you know, and he's like, and he'll cut them off, right? And they're like, "What? What are you doing?" And he's like, "You can't upload 5,000 images a minute, you know? Like, you're abusing what I created." We have that at Digg too. You'll have, you know, services will spike, you know, and we'll be like, what the heck is going on with the API? And then we'll find some IP at, you know, Southeastern Missouri State University that is just hammering the API, you know, like 500 requests a second. And that's because some graduate student fired up Python with threading and was, you know, sucking in all of our data. And, you know, we...
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, you know, and of course, we report this stuff to the authorities, and it'll be like, what? You mean I can't hit your API at 5,000 requests a second? It's like, no, dude, you can't. Yeah, it's funny, dude. There's, you know, it's what happens. Life goes on.
Life goes on, and the web pages get rendered, and grandma pictures get uploaded, and at some time it's going to go down at some point or another. But
yeah, there's too many moving pieces for it not to go down. You know, it's like, people don't buy a car and expect it never to break down. And, you know, no matter how well you build that car, even if it has two engines and 18 wheels, something's going to happen and it's going to go down. You know, and it's just the way things are.
Yep. It's all about how you respond to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Joe, I appreciate you coming on the show with us.
Thank
you for giving up your afternoon.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It was awesome. Great talking to you. Maybe we can get you back on down the road.
Oh, I would love it.
Sure. I'm.
And we can talk some more war stories at Digg.
Oh, I do podcasts for beer. So,
well,
yeah.
Chris lives in Michigan, and one of your favorite beers is there, Oberon.
Yes. Yeah. I love me some Oberon. I actually have a guy in Michigan that ships it out to me.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. I have a guy. If you need the name and number, let me know, Keith, and I'll get it to you. But yeah, I call him up. They make Oberon in mini kegs now.
Yeah.
And he ships me those mini kegs, and you know, I have little parties over here where it's over on time, and all the Michiganders, 10% of Digg are Michiganders.
10%, really?
10% of the employees of Digg are all from Michigan. Yeah.
Wow.
So
Well, I have some bad news for you, Joe.
What's that?
Did you hear about the issues that Bell Brewery is having with their hops?
No, don't tell me.
Oh, you didn't hear? Oh. Well, they get all their hops from a small grower in the Czech Republic, and they had a small loophole that allowed them to back out of their contract. So about 3 weeks ago, they backed out, and Bell, I think they've already found another supplier of their hops, but they were kind of left stranded for a supplier of their hops. So their recipes are not going to change, but their hops are coming from a different place. So
Uh-oh. Maybe
I'll send you a link to that.
Yeah, send me a link to that story. I'd be interested to hear more about that.
You know, we have a beer brewery in Mississippi now called Lazy Magnolia, and they make some really good beers. One of them is called a Southern Pecan. It's a really dark beer. It's fantastic.
Ooh, that sounds good.
That sounds like a nut brown. Is that what it was like a Motor City nut brown?
It does.
I don't know if it's like a nut brown, but it does have a pecanish flavor to it, and it's I don't know. Just go search Lazy Magnolia and check it out. It's actually won a lot of awards too, so it's actually not bad.
Well, let's check it out.
Well, I'll have to check out. Yeah, I'll have to check out Ashley's in Ann Arbor. They have pretty much any beer known to man.
Oh, I miss Ashley's.
Well, since we've degraded down to talking about beer now, so I guess we're done.
Yep, we're done. So.
All right, Joe, thanks for coming on the show again. We certainly appreciate it. Woody, it was always a pleasure to talk to you again.
Me too, sir.
Well, we certainly would like to thank our sponsor, Rentgate, today for sponsoring today's show. Hope you go out and try out some of their products and some of their services. Until next time, folks, we'll see you. Deep Fried Bites is out.
Bye, guys.